$1 million in damages premised on the breach of a claimed oral contract with respondent Vermilion State Bank. This appeal is rather unusual in that there are four independent grounds by which Tennis asserts that it's entitled to judgment as a matter of law, and failing that, a new trial premised primarily on instructional errors to the jury. Finally, there's a constitutional challenge to the 10% interest rate. There's been full briefing on the issues, and in the limited amount of time for oral argument, Tennis will address certain of the issues. The evidence as a matter of law fails to establish a contract was made between the parties on August 8, 2016. Minnesota law is well established that a contract, oral or otherwise, does not exist unless the parties agree with reasonable certainty about the same thing and on the same terms. And an enforceable contract requires reasonable certainty about the intent of the parties regarding the fundamental terms of the contract. An alleged contract which is vague, indefinite, and so uncertain as to place the meaning and intent of the parties in the realm of speculation is void and unenforceable. Here, there is no contract. Applying the de novo standard of review.
Ms. Hunter, what essential term are you saying is missing from this contract?
The essential term that's missing from this contract is exactly what Tennis was purportedly buying for $6.1 million. I mean, the problem with the bank's claim of contract is really evident beginning with its complaint. And I'm going to refer the court to count one. Its premise was that Tennis agreed to purchase Trojes from the bank for $6.1 million after bank purchased Trojes in the bankruptcy action. But Trojes was never the asset. The bank was never going to purchase Trojes, but only certain select assets of Trojes, which auction bid sheets were never provided to Tennis. And as evident at trial, there was never any agreement as to what Tennis was allegedly agreeing to purchase for $6.1 million. Tennis's position is spelled out in its letter of intent, which it testified responds to the party's oral discussions. It doesn't accept out the Wells Fargo lien trucks from any deal. It includes a non-compete, and it requires certain intangibles. It is signed by both Greg and Willie Tennis, affirming their joint authority to act on behalf of Tennis, which is in accord with the LLC's operating agreement. The bank received the letter of intent, signed by both Tennis brothers jointly, but asserts that in 2 one-minute calls it made with Greg Tennis alone, it states Greg was told the due diligence piece of the letter of intent doesn't work. The bank admits of no discussion regarding the rest of the letter. In fact, at trial, its assertion was made by the bank that it never even read the letter in full. Bank asserts that the question posed to Greg Tennis after its receipt of the letter of intent was, do you want it for $6.1 million? But there's no agreement as to what it is. The identification of an agreement in the assets is an essential element of contract.
Well, if that's the case, why did your client or one of them say yes?
Because he was referring to the letter of intent. He's looking at the letter of intent as what their discussions are, thinking that they're going ahead with the letter of intent. So that's the fundamental problem. And the letter of intent doesn't match anything that the bank asserts what they claim was being sold for $6.1 million. I mean, I think it's important to recognize that the bank was never actually buying anything in the auction for 6.1. It was actually bidding something much less, which it never told the Tennis brothers. The Tennis brothers never saw the auction sheets. And so what we have here is this letter of intent, and the letter of intent does not conform to what the bank asserts what was being sold. And so we have no agreement, we have no meeting of the minds, and we have no contract. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is if you look at their own presentation here, The bank has denied that the terms contained in the letter of intent form the basis of the contract. But then it presented a damage expert stating to the jury he assumed the letter of intent was the basis of the party's agreement, and then he presented his claim damage calculation on that basis. Now, one of the reasons that you want certainty is so that if you have a breach, you know what how to calculate damages. But here, nothing correlates with what the bank asserts the contract was, and there was never any agreement. And so what we have here is we have no contract, no enforceable contract, and the judgment should be reversed. As an aside, and there's we've raised a number of issues with regard to jury instructional errors, but the court even refused to give any jury instruction on what a letter of intent is. So the jury had no idea what that is. The court refused any instruction on the issue of authority, so the jury had no idea on that. So we have many reasons why there is error. The other issue I'd like to...
Ms. Nordhunt, the review of the denial of a motion for JMOL is a highly deferential standard. And I believe the record shows there was testimony by, and I don't want to mispronounce his name, but Mr. Popel, is that Popel? That the brothers agreed that they would buy the assets without those six natural gas trucks. So viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to Tennis, isn't there sufficient evidence to find that there was a contract with regard to what assets they were buying, that it was all the assets except those trucks?
No, because you have to look at the timing. Initially, the discussion, the oral discussion was that Tennis was not going to want the six trucks. Then there was the oral discussion that Tennis wanted the six trucks and Popel said no. Then you have the letter of intent. The letter of intent does not accept out the six trucks. And Popel testifies that after he gets the letter of intent, he states he recognized that the parties aren't in agreement. And there's no testimony after that in those 2 1-minute calls with regard to the six trucks. So there is no basis on this record that the court could conclude that the six trucks were included or excluded. I mean, there was no agreement. And I agree that there is a deferential standard in terms of how you view the evidence. On the other hand, it is de novo review, and it requires this court to look at the evidence as a whole, and as whether based on the evidence as a whole, there is a duty, you know, to reverse, and here there is. And it really fundamentally comes down to what that letter of intent does. And Popel's own testimony that he recognizes at that point, the parties aren't in agreement to whatever they had said before. I'd like to turn to the issue with regard to the statute of frauds. Now, here we have a situation where we don't have goods and services, we have goods and intangibles. When you have a mixture of goods and services, Minnesota law says you decide what is the predominant factor in the transaction. What the case law shows is that when you have goods and services, you have what the seller is selling is intertwined with the goods sold. So for example, you're buying a furnace and they're installing it. So it's inextricably intertwined. In those circumstances, to decide what the predominant factor is, you look at the language of the contract, the business of the supplier, and the intrinsic worth of the goods involved. Now, here we have goods and intangibles. there isn't really an intertwinement in those situations. So for example, when you're talking goods and intangibles, you'd be talking such things as, let's say, the trucks and the accounts receivable. And they're not intertwined. The court in this situation, Tennis asked that the court apply, that you divide it out, and that the UCC would apply to the goods, and that therefore the statute of frauds would render anything with regard to the goods unenforceable because it was not in writing. Now, if the court instead decides, well, the predominant factor test applies, when you have goods and intangibles, again, there's still no enforceable contract. If you look at the facts, what you have here is the business of the supplier is a bank. It obtained an appraisal of the Trogi's assets a year before the auction, and it assigned a fair market value to the goods of over $5 million and a liquidated value of 4.8. And in scoring the bids, Trogi's used the liquidated value of the assets. The bank had no idea whether Trogi's customers were even assignable, and it admitted to the bankruptcy court a need for a price adjustment if no assignment. So all the bank could really supply was the goods. The bank never even had the software, hardware, customer lists appraised for Trogi's. So that's why if you look at how the bids were scored, and that's how the determination of who won the auction, it is clear that the predominant factor here is goods, not intangibles. And on that grounds also, the judgment in favor of Vermilion State Bank should be reversed. We've raised also the issue of the clear and convincing evidence standard. This goes to the Supreme Court's decision in Christie, which involved an oral contract litigation for damages in the sale of land. And there the Supreme Court said, well, because of the inherent uncertainty in an oral contract, and to avoid the statute of frauds, that the statute of frauds applied. Here we have the same uncertainty concern. We don't have obviously.
Ms. Hunt, I had one question. I just wanted to go back to interrupt you. So apart from whatever you believe the contract is predominantly of, do you believe or do you agree that that's a fact question?
No, it's a question of law.
Okay, and what case do you cite for that?
We have cited a string of cases to the court. I think the lead one is the Duxbury case. I can quickly pull it out. But we have actually every case that the court has, Valley Farmers Elevator is, I think, the lead one. No, I'm sorry, it's Duxbury. Where the court said whether it's governed is a question of law, and there's been a string of cases afterwards where the question is the predominant factor between goods and services, and the court has always held it's a question of law in Minnesota. The court has not dealt with the question of goods and intangibles. It is Tennis' position that that likewise would be a question of law. So this court has de novo review on that question. Turning back to the one of the other grounds, which is the clear and convincing evidence standard. I mean, here the problem is the bank asked for a writing. And so we have the letter of intent was presented. And the only written response by the bank in all of this was, you know, thanks, we got it. The bank has absolutely no writings that correspond in any respect to what it claims to be a contract.
Ms. Nordhunt, what, in terms of whether the clear and convincing evidence standard should apply, there isn't any case that I think is directly on point with regard to the facts situation here. So what rule of Are you suggesting that we should apply? I mean, the Supreme Court has only required clear and convincing evidence in limited circumstances.
Well, I think the Christie case is interesting because the Supreme Court there recognized kind of the fundamental purpose of it is to avoid uncertainty in searches in situations. And one of the situations, obviously, is where you have like oral modification of a written contract. Well, here, clearly, a letter of intent isn't a contract. But you have the situation where the bank requested a writing that was provided to the bank, and that's it. I mean, there is no other response to that in writing. And so really, under those circumstances, the clear and convincing evidence standard should apply. I believe my time is up. I ask that this court reverse the judgment.
Thank you, Ms. Hunt. Mr. Bradford?
Thank you, Judge Connolly. May it please the court. My name is Mark Bradford, representing the respondent, Vermilion State Bank. We're asking the court to affirm in all respects. I think I'll start my comments where Ms. Nordhunt left off, which is the applicable burden of proof. It's, of course, our contention that the court properly instructed the jury on a preponderance of the evidence standard, which is, of course, what both parties initially requested in their proposed instructions. And we agree that Christie, the 2018 decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court, really is the guiding authority here. And that court, as we pointed out in our brief, identified really only three types of oral contracts that are susceptible to a heightened burden of proof. And there's good reason, as the court explained, to have a heightened burden of proof in those contexts. Christie involved the sale of land, and the Supreme Court reasoned that land has a quote unquote special status in the law as compared with other forms of property. Therefore, it makes sense to have a clear and convincing evidence standard. There's also a heightened standard for an alleged promise by someone to make a will. It makes sense in that circumstance because, of course, the promisor, by the time the issue has surfaced, is dead, and there's nobody to confirm the promise. It makes sense under that circumstance to have a heightened burden of proof. And then the last one is an oral modification of a written contract, which makes sense because the parties have determined between themselves to reduce their promise in writing. That's a very confined set of circumstances. And this court in Bolander versus Bolander, which is a published decision from 2006, recognized that there are limitations on the context in which oral contracts are susceptible to a heightened burden of proof. We don't have that here. And that really informs the second issue, which is the sufficiency of the evidence. As it's been pointed out, that is an extraordinarily high burden for Tennis to meet in this case. On a judgment as a matter of law, all of the factual inferences have to be resolved in our favor, and the court has to review the record and be able to conclude that no reasonable jury could have interpreted the evidence to conclude that an oral contract was made. The court properly instructed the jury, and I think my friend on the other side agrees, that as long as the parties have agreement on the fundamental terms of the contract, it's not necessary that the contract include every detail. And it sounds like the only contention that Tennis is making, and this was in response to your question, Judge Connolly, is that the only missing term of the contract, the only fundamental term they contend is missing, is what the parties were purchasing. In other words, what Tennis agreed to buy. And we pointed out in our brief, there are numerous places in the transcript the court can look for that. Transcript pages 155 to 157 is John Papel's testimony describing the conversations and detailing exactly what Tennis agreed to buy. He details that there was a conversation about the specific trucks to be included in the transaction. Originally, Tennis wanted the 6 natural gas trucks. The bank said, no, we're not acquiring those because they have Wells Fargo liens that we don't want to satisfy. And then they called back with their accountant on the line and said, we'll do the deal at $6.1 million without the six natural gas trucks. That's also on page 162 of the transcript.
What about the non-compete?
There was never discussion about the non-compete, and that was not a fundamental term of the party's oral agreement. There's a lot of reliance by Tennis on their letter of intent. And again, to overturn the verdict here, you would have to take their version of events as true as to what they intended by their letter of intent. William Tennis testified, I didn't even know it was a letter of intent. I just knew they needed something to confirm our contract before the auction started. He never read it. He just signed it. The context of that letter.
And I understand that argument. I wanted to switch to a question that Ms. Hunt raised. And I just the customer routes seem to be a very important part of this deal.
Yes.
How do you classify them? Do you think they're intangibles? Do you think they're services? What are the customer routes?
They're intangibles, and I would refer the court. These are cases that are actually cited in appellant's brief. They cite Morgan Publications versus Squire Publishers, which is out of the Missouri Court of Appeals from 2000. And then they also cite a case called Draco Corp. And both of those cases, I think, actually support affirmance here. Because what they say is a determination of whether goods or services or non-goods predominate is a question of fact. And number two is they.
Is there any, I assume there's no Minnesota case that says that.
That it's a question of fact?
Yes.
Yeah, but you're correct, Judge Connolly, but it's important to note that the procedural context of the cases that have come before the court, either the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court, have been very different than those presented here. In those cases, the parties agreed on the facts. They agreed, and in virtually every case, there was a written contract. So the parties agreed on the facts. The only disagreement in those cases is what effect those facts had under the UCC. Here we have a difference of views on what the facts are. Did the parties enter into an agreement? What was the value of the products that were transferred and assets that were transferred as part of the contract? And virtually every court that has examined the issue has said, where the parties dispute the underlying facts, the question of what predominates is a question of fact. And I would refer.
Counsel, is it a pure question of fact, or is it a mixed question of fact and law?
It's a mixed question of fact and law. And I would refer the court to another Minnesota decision that's cited in appellant's brief, and it's the One Beacon Insurance case. And that's a decision from this court in 2009. And that court expressly says, this case is before us on a summary judgment posture, and the party seeking to avoid the UCC did not introduce any evidence to create a genuine issue of material fact with respect to the predominant purpose of the contract. So what that case basically says is, and as most of the Minnesota cases have addressed the issue, is the parties don't disagree on any of the facts. Here we have a very, very different circumstance. And if you agree with us that it's a question of fact, then affirmance is required because there was ample evidence that the predominant purpose of this contract was the transfer of the customer routes. Everybody testified that the value in Trojes was the customer routes. And when I mean everyone, I'm including the Tennis brothers. We cited in our brief the specific testimony where both Greg and Willie Tennis agreed that the value in this company was the customer routes, that they thought those customer routes would fit in perfectly with their business, and that the value of those routes, as they estimated it, was $5.3 million, which is a substantial, obviously a substantial part of the contract. The question about whether the jury was instructed on what that means, I have a couple comments on that. Number one is, it's important to note, the judge denied Tennis summary judgment on the predominant purpose of the contract 7 months before trial, saying this was a jury issue. Nevertheless, Tennis never requested a jury instruction on what predominant purpose means. Moreover, both lawyers argued the same thing, that predominant means what predominant means, which is what is the most valuable part of this contract. Both lawyers argued that consistently, and the evidence clearly shows that the most valuable part of this contract was the.
You know, I understand that the appellants didn't request a jury instruction, but let's say for the sake of argument, we agree with you that, you know, this is a contract of goods and intangibles. Let's agree for the sake of argument that, you know, to determine whether the predominant factor, if the parties disagree, you know, that goes to the jury as a fact question, as it did here in one of the special verdict questions. But and that this is sort of a new issue for Minnesota. If that's the case, then even if they didn't request it, shouldn't that instruction have been given even under a plain error standard of review?
Well, a couple points on that, Judge. I don't read their briefs as arguing plain error. Plain error is not mentioned in their briefs, number one. Number two is, even under the plain error standard, there has to be some prejudice. So the question is, what would the instruction have been? And remember, we proposed, Vermilion proposed an instruction that ultimately wasn't given precisely because Tennis didn't want the instruction given, number one. Number two is, if the instruction had been given, right, the question would have been, well, what does predominate mean? And if you just look up that standard word in the dictionary, you're going to see it means majority or the most. And that's exactly what both lawyers argued to the jury, is that the majority of this contract, the majority of the value of this contract was in the customer routes. This isn't a situation, for example, where the lawyers are disagreeing about what standard applies, and therefore the judge has to resolve that disagreement and instruct the jury. Here, the lawyers, it's apparent in their closing arguments, both agreed that the standard was what has the majority of the value in this contract. You'll see it right in Tennis's counsel's closing argument, where he says, this is on pages 788 and 89, the predominant factor in a contract depends on what the most money is being spent for. All lawyers agreed. And so there's no prejudice here. There's no indication that the jury was somehow confused by the absence of an instruction. And certainly there's no plain error or a mistake of fundamental law under these circumstances. The last point I want to address is, and this is not an issue that Ms. Nordhunt addressed in her presentation, but it is raised in the briefs, which is the absence of an instruction on UCC warranties. And we, of course, took the position in our brief that those warranties are inapplicable, of course, because the UCC doesn't apply to this contract, because it's predominantly one for intangibles, non-goods. But the implied warranty of merchantability, you'll see when you actually look at the Minnesota statute, also says that it only applies where the seller is a merchant in goods of the kind sold. The bank here is not a merchant in selling garbage trucks or trash routes. And therefore, that implied warranty does not apply as a matter of law. Unless there's any further questions, I would usually say I'd sit down, but I'm already sitting, so I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bradford. Ms. Hunt, you'll have the last word.
Yes, I want to go back to the issue of whether there's a contract, and I refer the court to the trial testimony, and specifically in the reply brief, I've quoted it, Mr. Popo's testimony. And then you got this letter of intent signed by both of them, referring to the Tennis Brothers, which plainly states an understanding wholly different from that which you claim to have had, right? That's right. So after that, you have two 1-minute conversations. Popol admits that there was no discussion about a non-compete, which is what Tennis said would be required for any definitive agreement for any contract. There was no discussion about the customer lists. There was no discussion about the trucks. So how on this record can you conclude that there was a meeting of the minds and there was a contract? And then you couple that with their damage expert that sits before the jury and says, well, I assumed the letter of intent was the contract, and that's what he was basing his damage calculations on. So if you're the jury, this makes absolutely no sense. And the court has de novo review in this circumstance. And I ask that the court go back and look at this specifically in terms of the timing with that letter of intent, Popol's testimony, and the fact that there is just simply no agreement as to what would be encompassed in $6.1 million. With regard to the issue of the statute of frauds, the issue here is one of law. In my reply brief, I have cited the string authority in every case that we could find. The court has always held it's a question of law. And so it's always been Tennis's position. It's a question of law, not a question of fact for the jury. The problem in this case is kind of mixing up what is meant by the predominant with motivation. When we're talking about predominant, we have to look at really what is, one of the questions is the value. And the value is looking at the Hoff appraisal. I don't know how you can divorce how you judge the auction bids from the value. And the value here was based on goods, not services, because the bank's own attorney admitted to the bankruptcy court that, I mean, price would have to be reduced because they don't know if these contracts are assignable. They don't own the contracts. Nobody owns the contracts. So that's why when you're looking, if you're going to predominant factor test, it necessarily is one of law, and it should be based on looking at the auction bids and the fact that the goods were the predominant factor.
Ms. Nordhunt, how can it be purely a question of law when in this case, there seems to be conflicting evidence as to the value of the different assets, both tangible and intangible?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, that would, you know, could generally be true, but that's part of the problem with this whole, the nature of this whole very case as to why there's not a contract. I mean, that's why we start there. But if you're going to find a contract, then the court has to decide, okay, what is the predominant factor? What are the terms of the contract? And my problem is I don't know how you can ever decide on this record that there was an agreement as to the terms of the contract. But if you get there somehow, then it is a question of law. You have to decide, okay, this is a contract. Now, looking at the supplier, I mean, there's a number of factors that the courts applied when you're looking at goods and services. You look at who the supplier is, you look at the terms of the contract, and then you look at the intrinsic value. And I think you can hear when you're looking at intrinsic value, why wouldn't you use the appraisal that was commissioned by the bank itself in valuing Trogi's assets? And incidentally, does not assign any value to the intangibles such as customer lists, et cetera. So that's why it is appellant's position on this record, this judgment simply cannot stand, and we ask that this court reverse.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hunt. Thank you very much, Mr. Bradford. The matter is submitted, and I hope you both stay safe and well.
Likewise, Judge. Thank you.
Thank you.